So can you tell like our listeners like what you do at Iron Root and who Iron Root Republic is?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name's Josh. I guess anytime when you're part of a growing company and it's a relatively small crew, you end up doing a lot of different things. But I do a lot of the sort of software admin, you know, kind of back office stuff, as well as some digital marketing things with one of the owners, Robert, and his wife, Kylie. Kind of work together on, you know, social media and the email newsletter and the websites and all that kind of stuff, as well as on-site sales and events and festivals here and there, going out and doing stuff kind of in the marketplace alongside our sales team. So, but everybody gets a chance to kind of help customers and taste things and participate in different aspects of the process here, being a relatively small team. Although, we did just grow to, I think about, what are we, about 12 people or something now?
Wow. Nice.
Yeah. So that's, yeah, my primary responsibilities are kind of those things, but it ends up being a little bit of everything. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
But, kind of the quick spiel about the distillery itself. I know you guys have tried a little bit of the whiskey so far, but obviously Texas Distillery, we're one of the most northernmost Texas distilleries in a town called Denison, which is just barely shy of the Oklahoma border. So one of the owners likes to say you drive north on the highway from Houston and Austin, and all those kind of central Texas towns. And the moment you see Oklahoma, you hit the brakes and we're just right there off the highway. So we're coming up this year is actually our 10th anniversary. So we've been going for almost 10 years now, and it's a family owned, craft distillery, owned by two brothers, Robert and Jonathan Licorice, who are both also gingers with beards, if you can believe
that. I was just going to ask, like, is this like a requirement to work there?
Yeah. I mean, it's not required. It's just strongly suggested to,
yeah, well, to be a ginger. Hey, you came in for an interview and they just looked at you and they were just like, well, this is too beautiful not to hire.
That's right. No, actually it was my whole history of coming here was a real, you know, kind of right place at the right time, twist of fate kind of thing. Got to know these guys for a while before actually, growing the team and moving. My wife and I moved from Austin up here for me to come and work at the distillery.
Wow.
So they, you know, they're two brothers, gingers, as I said, that Jonathan's the head distiller, the head blender, and Robert's also done a lot of distillings and stuff, but he does a lot more on sort of the marketing and sales side these days. And their mother, Marcia, is the distillery manager, known affectionately throughout the Texas whiskey industry as the mother of Texas whiskey. She definitely mothers everybody who comes through the doors here. And we got a whole bunch of other folks that work here. John, their dad retired and came to kind of help out and do some stuff around here. Also affectionately known as the intern, around here. We've got Ashley who helps with the distillery management and kind of runs the tasting room up here. I've got a sales team of Philip and Nellie and Shannon and Chris, who you might have seen in as Liquor Hound on YouTube.
Yeah.
Also does some of the blending work for our Saints Alley product line. So yeah, I mean, it's kind of been this growing team over the last maybe about year and a half, coming up on year and a half.
Does it with a team that size, does it ever feel, and you're sort of like, obviously whiskey has this allure and there's mythology around it and stuff. You ever feel like you're like on a pirate ship? Is it kind of like just the wild bunch of, you know, it's like, all right, I can't believe this is our job, or does it feel very like, all right, it's just I'm just a day at the office?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think there's always a lot of focus on the very more romantic aspects of whiskey, right? And any sort of spirits or distillation or anything. Anytime you're aging spirits in oak barrels, it's a very like romantic, artistic kind of thing. And so that's definitely a huge element. And I think something that draws all of us to it in different ways. But at the same time, I don't want to say that folks forget. I think they do recognize that it is a business like any other that needs to order things and pay invoices and make sales and do all of these, kind of boring office type stuff. So it's kind of a balance of the two. You get to do this interesting, creative, romantic, fun stuff and meet all sorts of cool people and have interesting, unique experiences that you would never have outside of the sure. spirits industry. But at the same time, you know, you kind of have to ship out pallets on of bottles and things like that. I think for us, I mean, for me specifically, the best thing now that I've been in the industry a while and had all sorts of experiences and stuff is getting to have those customers come in and have a great experience and taste something that they've never tasted before and see them experience that kind of joy and excitement that reminds me of like when I first got interested and I first tried Iron Root for the first time. Getting to share that with people is really kind of the most special part now, I think, of the day to day, if you will.
So professional pirates.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, we semi-professional pirates.
So like
go ahead, Al.
Texas whiskey, in the most cases, is matured much shorter lengths in time because of the geography. Did mm-hmm. you guys ever source in the beginning, or did you just like make it? We're going to wait, and then before we ever start selling, like what was that runway when you first started?
Right. Yeah. No. That kind of plays into kind of gave you the quick backstory of the folks at the distillery, but that's starting to touch on more. How do we do what we do and make what we make, and how is the dynamics of creating spirits in Texas different than you know other regions that create spirits? So that's a whole huge rabbit hole. That's a lot Good. Of fun to go down. So where do I begin with that? I guess. First of all, no, we actually came to any sort of sourcing later. It's very typical for folks to source from, you know, MGP or other distilleries to kind of get going and get some cash flow without having to do the full aging. We started with vodka, gin, and moonshine, so selling clear spirits. Cool. Early on, but in terms of the whiskey, it's always been in-house until we started sourcing later on to kind of help meet the demand and also do a little bit of a be able to use our aging and blending and cask finishing expertise that we learned over the years making the in-house product and apply it to something that's a little bit of a different concept with the Saints Alley line, which I think you guys got to try one of those.
So I've tried yeah, I forget what it's called now. And then someone also sent me, because the reason I even heard about you guys in the first place was we were tasting like another Texas whiskey, and someone's like, you haven't had Texas whiskey until you've had Iron Root. And they were like really adamant, like huge fans. And then so I was like, well, I got to reach out and like see. But they also sent me like the Nobleman, I think it was called. And then Herald. So okay. I've tasted both of those. Yeah, from the Saints Alley line.
Got it. Yeah, so to just maybe it makes sense to kind of walk through, you know, how we make the in-house product, because then that plays cool. into where Saints Alley comes from.
Yeah.
So for anything that's distilled and aged and blended and bottled 100% here on site is under the Iron Root name. Okay. So like Harbinger or Promethean, some of our more limited, you know, annual releases like Hubris and Icarus, corn whiskeys, things like that, are all going to be pot distilled. And the focus for us is using heirloom, mostly corn, but other heirloom grain varieties as a component of our mash bill, right? So where you might be familiar with traditional Kentucky high rye bourbon using rye as a component as that flavoring grain, or wheated bourbon using wheat in that same way. We do a little bit of rye and a little bit of wheat and everything as well, but really kind of what we're mainly focused on is using these heritage heirloom corn varieties as flavoring grains. So we may have, say, 80% of a bourbon mash bill being composed of yellow corn, and then the remaining 20% might be purple corn or bloody butcher corn. So rather than it being, you know, 100% these specialty grains, because they can be pretty powerful flavor-wise and bring a lot of intensity, will use it in the same kind of proportions that you might see a traditional high rye bourbon or a traditional wheated bourbon. We'll get most of that stuff as much as possible grown within about 50, 60 miles of the distillery locally, as much as we can, to kind of try and support and engage with that local agriculture and support that notion of terroir. A lot of people refer to, you know, the grains coming from the place. Yeah, that all gets pot distilled and then aged largely in individual casks. So that's another kind of unique thing people like to ask. You tried the Harbinger. A natural question for people is to say, well, what's the mash bill of Harbinger? Well, there really isn't a specific set recipe for us. Wow. We take an approach to whiskey distillation that's a lot like it's really inspired by what they call élevage in France. When they're distilling different types of brandy like Armagnac and Cognac, where they'll use different grape varietals. They may age them separately in different barrels. And throughout their aging life, as they're being brought to maturity, they may be adjusted and moved and proof adjusted in the barrel and all of these different things. So that's one where Jonathan, our head distiller, really was inspired by this heritage of French distilling and French brandies and adapted it for use in the Texas climate. So we use kind of a Texas élevage to age our barrels and especially when it comes to the blending as well. So that's using those different corn varietals, almost like they're different types of grapes that you would see in wines and brandies, and aging them in separate types of barrels, American oak, European oak, French oak barrels, hybrid casks that we get specially made for us. And so what you end up with is just to the left of me here is a warehouse filled of a mix of different mash bills with different flavors and different wood types that can then be gone through one by one and assessed and adjusted and have some water added to the cask as needed, slowly proofed down over time as we get closer to bottling especially. And you end up with this palette of flavors to draw from to then bring together into something like a Harbinger or a Promethean, or of course, some of them get selected as standing and being exceptional on their own as single barrels and things right. like that.
With that process, how do you maintain a sort of continuity in a vertical or continuity in a particular, you know, the Harbinger, for example, like?
Right, from batch to batch. So we do embrace a little bit of batch to batch variance.
Sure.
You know, same as vintages and wine would be, or if you go to different years of brandy. Right. They should be very similar to each other, but you'll find some differences, especially if you go back, you know, for us, if you went back 5-6 years ago, the age statement was lower than it is today. You know, we've been creeping that up over time.
Sure.
So the Harbinger, for example, that you're seeing now has a little bit more age on it than it did 5, 6, 8 years ago, right?
Yeah. Oh, I love that. That's cool. I like that. I really like the comparison to wine. I think that's a fun area to draw inspiration from, just the making.
Right. Yeah. So we do want some consistency and so we will compare against specific batches of Harbinger that maybe say won an award. It won, you know, World's Best Bourbon in 2020 for the World Whiskeys Awards. So there's always a comparing back to that batch. What did we really like about that? Can we at least make this as good as, or not, if not better, this time around as the one that did so well in competitions. We'll compare it against the last 4 or 5 that came out, you know, in the recent past. And so we're able to adjust these blends, or really Jonathan's vision for adjusting these blends is to maintain a certain level of consistency, but also accepting the fact that there's some kind of alchemy and magic to it that you can't just quantify and make dead on consistent all the time.
Yeah.
So you should be able to taste any batch of Harbinger and recognize that flavor profile overall. But hey, maybe this one's a little bit more maple than the last one, or this one's a little darker than the last one. But, you know, they're within, you know, a very similar range. And I think that's true of most distilleries. If you sit down and do that vertical comparison, like you were saying.
I find that really interesting because I think like, the way continuity works in like the really large producers is just by sheer volume, right? It just like inevitably you're mixing so much together that you're going to have a continuity. What I love about craft whiskeys is opportunity to go in another direction, to say like, hey, we're going to actually, we are going to be changing a little bit batch to batch, and there is going to be these variations. And like, of course, I know about like the Solera process, but I'd never heard of Elevage until I was reading your bio and seeing that, like, I was like, oh, wow. I just didn't think like that was part of the conversation with whiskey. So it's really exciting to see.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's really at the core of everything. The approach to everything here is that French inspired process that's, you know, kind of adapted to our own Texas élevage, you know, inspired by that old world tradition. And it really, it can't really be simplified down to, oh, just adding water to the barrel before bottling or something like that. This is a very hands-on barrel by barrel sensory assessment. If it's great as is, leave it alone. If it needs adjusting, if it needs to be moved, if it needs a little water added to knock that proof down, because you'll actually pull off different flavors at different proofs. We want to give time for the water and the alcohol and everything that's in the barrel to get to know each other and integrate well, rather than proofing it quickly, which can cause a lot of issues, especially when you're working with pot still distillate. So it's a very meticulous, hands-on, you know, very carefully crafted process all along each individual barrel's lifespan to maturity. So we're really kind of guiding it along and developing a relationship with each barrel as it goes along to harvest.
And what is the, like, are your barrels in like a rickhouse style thing, or are you temperature controlling anything, like, or are you just sort of leaning into the heat of Texas?
Leaning into the heat for the most part. And now we're in far north Texas and close to a pretty large lake up here. So our temperature swings are maybe a little less extreme than some other places, but it still gets pretty dang hot. So it's not temperature controlled. We do a lot of environmental control, and that's another part of the kind of élevage process of monitoring the temperature, monitoring the humidity and the atmospheric pressure and all these things. And so we'll open up the garage bay doors back here in the warehouse to let airflow come through. And if it's, you know, if it needs additional humidity, we may throw some water on the floor with a hose and let it, you know, the air kind of humidify that way to create more of a damp warehouse environment. But the only temperature control that exists back there are some heaters. If it's just really, really cold and we don't want the pipes to freeze on that, those once or twice a year when it gets really cold here. So those heaters will get kicked on. The other thing, I guess there is really two purposes to that. The other thing that can happen is we develop such a relationship and through this élevage process of knowing the temperament or the behavior or the swings that each barrel will go through. One thing that we've noticed is that when it's really, really hot outside, you're extracting a bunch of fresh tannin into the spirit, right? Which can be a little bit rough and spicy and needs some time to kind of soften and mature out. So pulling barrel samples when it's really, really hot is not ideal for us typically. And then the opposite is true. When it's really, really cold, they kind of go dormant and go to sleep, where the whiskey might taste fine, but a little flat. And you can even find within the same day, if it swings, you know, 20 degrees plus or minus, you know, in the morning, it may taste a little flat. And by the afternoon, it's kind of woken up a little bit.
Wow.
So every once in a while, if it's, we just got to pull some samples, but it happens to be really cold that day, we can kind of warm up the warehouse a little bit to get a more representative sample of what that whiskey wants to express itself like. But you know, other than that, we just sort of embrace the environment and the swings here. And part of our approach of the types of barrels we choose and the way we manage this warehouse and is to kind of, I guess, work with that environment to make the whiskey express in the best way it possibly can, because I'm sure you've heard folks maybe say something like it ages faster.
Yeah.
Here. I like to say it ages differently. I mean, time moves at the same rate, but the dynamics of what we're dealing with is always going to produce a different result than someplace like Kentucky or certainly Ireland, Scotland or right. We're dealing with a whole different dynamic situation here in Texas, and it's really just the ability to work with that and harness it, and knowing the different types of approaches and techniques you can use to create a unique style of whiskey that's expressing still as a mature spirit.
I think that. Go ahead, Al. Go ahead. first of all, it just dawned on me that you should, when we think about age statements, it would be pretty funny to put a time statement. I'll see if it pours better in the afternoon, you know, 3:18 p.m., you know.
Timestamp it, yeah.
Well, timestamp it would be a pretty funny idea. Yeah. I think I'd be like, if it's Texas, I should buy it. I should get a 3:30, not a 1 o'clock.
Yeah,
like,
that's right. Early afternoon.
That's right. Yeah, you don't want the polls on a Friday either. That's right.
I just, you know, hey, free marketing idea.
I love it.
I guess I'm curious too. It's like, I feel like it's more a statement than a question, but I feel like a lot of people are looking at Texas right now because we're in New York. And the Northeast is experiencing warmer weather every season. It's the warmest winter we've had. I mean, it's barely had any snow. And, you know, when half the story here is like we have real cold, rough winters and suddenly we don't, Texas is an interesting place to look at. So, like, all right, well, what the hell are they doing about this?
Right. Yeah, it's also the oldest distilleries here in Texas are coming up on, 15 years old. Now,
right.
So we're kind of maybe the second wave, if you will, behind folks like Balcones, Garrison Brothers, that have been around, you know, a few years longer than we have. But in terms of distillery lifetimes, everybody here is still very, very young, right?
Even
at 15 years old. So there's been a real process of everybody, whether it's us or folks more in the Central Hill Country region, anywhere here, figuring out what kind of whiskey this place wants to make and how best to harness, you know, the ingredients and the land and the talents of the people and certainly the aging environments. And there's been this evolution over the last 10, 15 years where the whiskey's gotten better and better and better. And there's been an insane number of experiments and one-offs. And, you know, I mean, if you look at the number of expressions that people have released to different distilleries here over the last decade, it's crazy. But now I feel like from what I've seen in the last 3-4 years, you've really started to see a coming of age moment where people are really starting to hone in on, okay, this is something we really like that comes out of here. We like to use this type of grain, these sorts of barrels, age them with this approach and this philosophy, blend it this way. And, you know, certainly we have our own version of that. But I think that's something where Texas is gone from being the weird kids in the corner doing crazy experimental stuff to wow, they've really started to dial this into something that's truly exceptional.
Yeah.
So do you feel like there is then a connectivity between all the Texas distillers that's starting to like form?
Oh, absolutely. It's been that way for quite a while. You know, if you're sort of part of the community of the folks who both own and work and you know, kind of exist in the consumer space around the Texas whiskey scene, there's a ton of people who all know each other, and we don't always get to see one another because we're very spread out. You know, like every city's and many hours drive apart. But anytime there's a festival or an event or something like that, and we get a chance to go and see all these folks, it's like a little bit of a family reunion type of thing. You know, I mean, I have friends at lots of distilleries from when my wife and I lived in the Austin area, and lots of folks that I know that are just kind of whiskey enthusiasts, and everybody's really supportive of one another. Typically, there's collaborations that happen. There's, you know, knowledge that gets shared. And for the most part, there tends to be kind of a rising tide lifts all ships mentality, which is wonderful to see. Competitors, sure. I mean, you know, in a sense, we're all competing with one another for shelf space and dollars that people have to spend on spirits and things like that. But, you know, if if we win an award or we get some notoriety or we gain some sort of supporter or fan, I'm more than happy to tell them, hey, go check out, you know, Balcones, Andalusia, Garrison Brothers, you know, any of these other folks that are running awesome distilleries doing cool stuff. And they do the same for us. I mean, we have people stop through here all the time and say, hey, I was just down in, you know, visiting so-and-so at this distillery. And they said, oh man, you got to go up and try it. I know it's a long way, but go check out Iron Root. So yeah, it's a very supportive community all around, I'd say.
Awesome. Can you talk about the St. Sally? Yeah, that's kind of a collaboration.
Yeah, absolutely. So St. Sally is, I guess let me start with kind of how it's come together. Chris, Liquor Hounds on YouTube, which of course, one of the OG, you know, been reviewing spirits on YouTube for over 10 years or something now, I want to say it is, and has a phenomenal, incredible palate, all kinds of experience, an insane collection at his house, and just the nicest, most humble guy you'll ever meet. Chris used to be he worked for the Postal Service. He was a mailman since like 1980s, I want to say. And he would pick up spirits here and there since the 80s and got interested in tequila and then got interested in rum and then got into whiskeys and so on and so forth and sort of accumulated this collection and experiences and then eventually started doing his own reviews and was one of the original guys to start doing that on YouTube. And he lives down in Fort Worth, so about an hour and a half from the distillery here. And he met, I want to say, Robert and Marcia at some whiskey festival when Iron Root was still pretty young, you know, several years ago, but was coming out with some interesting creative products. And he tasted it and thought it was good quality and was really interested and got to be friends with them. And, you know, over the course of years, they decided to say, let's work with Chris and leverage some of his knowledge and some of his talent and experience to create kind of a different concept from the Iron Root line. And so what St. Sally is we'll source MGP high rye bourbon for the most part. And you also tried the Nobleman you mentioned. It's rye whiskey, but same concept for both. And that will get blended. That sourced product will get blended with Iron Root. So you will get that classic, familiar, column distilled bourbon or rye combined with this heirloom grain, Texas matured, pot distilled, you know, a lot of flavor intensity, a lot of viscosity, pulls a lot of flavor from these barrels. Those two get blended together. So you get sort of a best of both worlds base whiskey. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm. Then that base whiskey will be put into different types of finishing casks. So you tried the Nobleman, that was a Tokaj cask, so Hungarian dessert wine for the rye. Also the Armagnac cask for the Herald. So it'll spend time in those finishing barrels. And by the time, you know, it's depending on when it's ready, 6 months, 12 months, however long it spends in the finishing casks, the whiskey will get pulled out of there and then blended back with the original base whiskey that's unfinished to bring it sort of into a balance where it's still recognizable as a bourbon or as a rye whiskey. And that finishing barrel's not overwhelming or drowning it in wine flavors or other spirit flavors, but it's just kind of a supporting accent is kind of the approach there. So yes, sourcing some product and blending it with some of our own, but then using our approach to the in-house product, all of this meticulous aging and meticulous blending to kind of a different concept to do a cask finish bourbon or a cask finish rye that's balanced in the way that we like to see.
It's delicious. What was like a challenge you guys kind of faced in those first maybe 5-6 years, or even looking back at the entirety of the last 10 years or so that you had to overcome? And then also on the other side of that, what was like a moment where you guys were like, oh, okay, we're doing something right. this is like a moment of like validation. So yeah, I imagine there's sort of like, you know, a time period where like, all right, we're going, we're going to do this. And now, you know, oh, here comes our first big challenge. And then finally some kind of moment of like, all right, we did it.
Right, right. That's the early days I've only heard stories about because I've, you know, I've been doing work for the distillery for several years now, but I've actually only been an employee for a little over a year now, full time here. Yeah. But I've heard some stories from the early days where it was even more sort of, you said pirate, I'm going to say Wild West like, you know, back then. Mm-hmm. And I think the biggest challenge for any distillery starting out is you may have wonderful products and be pouring your heart and soul into it, but it's a pretty crowded marketplace in a lot of ways. And it's hard to get, you know, attention and a good distribution set up and get into retailers and have them support you and get into bars and restaurants and have them support you. So that's really an uphill battle, you know, for attention and shelf space and dollars and just getting people to give the new thing a try. So that's kind of an uphill battle for some years until you start getting some recognition and awards and things help with that. Cause it just gets your name out there and people say, oh, well, it must be pretty good. Let me give it a try. So, you know, our corn whiskey Hubris won World's Best Corn Whiskey. I forget the original year. So that kind of helped propel things forward and get some notoriety. Certainly some of the approach that, that Robert and Kylie and myself have taken over the years of doing things like interacting online a bunch, you know, having a good relationships with local whiskey clubs and national and international whiskey clubs, YouTube channels, all that kind of stuff, kind of helps get your name out there as well. Mm-hmm. But the real turning point when it started to move a little bit from a, you know, a small cult favorite sort of thing, but with some notoriety, to something that was really starting to grow a little more exponentially was winning the World's Best Bourbon Award in the World Whiskies Awards in 2020. So that went from, you know, folks would pick up and buy Harbinger and it had good reviews and was well received for a while to, you can't find it anywhere on shelves. So now you have the opposite problem. So now you have the opposite problem, that we're just kind of starting to move past and overcome is you can't make enough of it fast enough. You have a time delay in whiskey, right? So no one foresaw that Harbinger would gain so much attention and suddenly be unavailable everywhere overnight. And we'd send some whiskey out the door and it was like throwing bottles into a black hole because like you would just send it out the door and poof, it's gone. Yeah. So, you know, we're making more and sending out more and it's becoming a little more available now several years later. But that was the real big pivot point, I think, to start on a little more of an upward growth trajectory for us was, you know, that's a big award to get your name on a lot of people's radar. You know,
I'm so interested in the idea of when that happens. I mean, you have the allure of like allocated bourbons and stuff in the marketplace. And of course there's a secondary marketplace and all these things that are happening. But from a marketing standpoint, building on the mythology of something like that, other than you can see, obviously it's like, this is award winning, but it's award winning and you cannot get your hands on it is in one way it's a bummer because it's not like you're selling on the secondary market. You got to still make product and sell it, but you also can like build the mythology a little bit. There's an interesting opportunity, high class problem to run out of really good stuff in a way, from a storytelling standpoint, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. It's great. And I mean, you know, awards can be very controversial and of course, I mean, it's all incredibly subjective at the end of the day and we get that. So, I mean, I try not to harp on the award thing too much, you know, lean on it too heavily. It's great for getting your name out there. It's great for getting some interest and nice to be recognized amongst a bunch of other wonderful spirits as being something that stands up to some of the best stuff out there. So that's all wonderful. But you do kind of reach this point with where the mythology, as you say, or the excitement over it. If you can't continue to supply new and exciting things to people that are of high quality and meet their expectations, then you can kind of lose momentum. And fortunately, through a lot of Jonathan's kind of innovative ideas and a lot of the things that Chris has done on the Saints Alley side, I mean, that's really helped to not lose the momentum that's gained from, oh, huge award, it's sold out everywhere and you can't find it for 3 years, you know? So people start to, you know, look elsewhere. But if you're able to continue to supply a little bit of interesting stuff and continue to put some product out there, it really helps. So that's another key piece of the Saints Alley thing is you're able to get, it's not 100% made here in house, but it does have a lot of our expertise and care and attention put to it, rather than, hey, we just source some product and put it in a bottle, which is fine, but you know, we're doing a lot of extra work to it. So you're getting a product that's definitely got the Iron Root stamp put on it with the Saints Alley line that we're able to supply in a little bit greater volume as we scale up here. And you know, the goal is to be able to get, Harbinger or whatever anybody's favorite Iron Root whiskey is, you know, to be available to you whenever you need it. But, you know, the reality of whiskey distilling is you have such a time delay built into your product. And, you know, it's never the goal for us to put out anything that's rushed or inferior or, you know, we could harvest some barrels out of the warehouse right now and slap a Harbinger label on it, but that's not the goal. The goal is to make it as good or better than everything that's come before.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's sort of short-sighted. I could see the allure of that when you can sell on a label, but when you have something award-winning or that people really cherish the flavor of, even if, like, you know, we talk about continuity, but even the idea that it's like the tastemaker, if it is sort of batch to batch, the thing that you're looking for, then the tastemaker matters. And if the tastemaker starts to slack, you know, what do? You know, you're going to lose. That's the long term. That's not ever going to be great for the brand. And it's so really interesting.
That's it. You nailed it. It's trying to take a longer term perspective, even though it's very tempting to rush more out the door.
Sure.
And you know, that's not been the goal for us at all. And I think that's certainly a right choice. I mean, that's the approach that I believe in and can stand behind. You know, love to make sales and get the product in people's hands and continue all of the excitement and make people happy. But I don't want to do it at the sacrifice of the quality of the product.
Yeah, you definitely got to, like, especially now with craft distilling so popular, you got to make it count when you are in someone's hands. I see a lot of, like, interesting things happening with, like, distillery visits or tours. Do you guys have a tap? Like, can people come and visit and like, what kind of experiences are they able to have there?
Yeah. So we are open throughout the week, but for the official tour, those are on Saturdays at the moment, although we're looking at ways to grow and offer some different varieties of experiences, you know, maybe do some stuff that's a little more quick and you know, if you just want to drop in for a 30-minute visit and you can get a little bit of a tour versus something that's maybe really in depth for the whiskey nerds out there and you spend a few hours here, and we're looking at, you know, how we can make some of those things happen. And we do some one-off special events here and there as well, but we do offer standard tours at the moment. There is a tasting room here where you can sample all the whiskeys, and it's a, you know, a bottle shop and all of that. That has some pretty near term, I'd say maybe hopefully before the end of the year, to be finished out and have a little bit of a new concept applied to it. Cause what happened was, is we win this big award, have all this notoriety happen. And that was right at the time that the whole world shut down. And so there was, we were selling bottles out of the distillery here, you know, kind of a contactless sort of thing. And they enclosed the what used to be the front patio of the distillery, enclosed that with the intention of this becoming more of a tasting room, cocktail lounge, that sort of a thing. They had, you know, historically it had a cocktail lounge here open more in the production space, but you know, they closed it off. And right about that time, it made no sense to continue investing in opening a bar the time. So that kind of that project got delayed a little bit. And in the meantime, we're about to embark on a construction project of a new barrel warehouse here on site, over double, I think, the storage capacity that we have here, because it's pretty full over here in the barrel warehouse at the moment. So that's kind of the priority, to expand the capability to have space for aging and move our bottling line out to one of the buildings and so on. And then we'll finish out the tasting room and start looking at providing, you know, some more experiences, some cocktails, you know, all that type of stuff. So more to come on that, but it's definitely on the radar once we sort of clear out the space and are able to finish it out.
Well, that's great. I think that's a really exciting to have something that is growing so well, that is obviously winning awards and people are loving, and just, you know, it's a high class problem to be like, well, the future's coming. It's just not here yet.
That's right. There's a lot of moving parts and pieces, and there's kind of a right order of operations, you know. Sure. We've got to prioritize the barrel warehouse first, and then do what we can with the tasting room space for now until we're able to kind of shift and focus on that. But yeah, there's a lot of great plans in the works to have greater experiences for people and have lots of fun stuff to come up here and see us and do. And I mean, the whole area up here around Denison is growing exponentially right now as well. A lot of semiconductor manufacturing coming in and, lots and lots of growth. And so we want to, you know, keep pace with that and you know, be one of the cornerstone businesses of the area and you know, kind of keep pace with the growth of the Denison and Sherman areas is going to be huge over the next couple of years, I think.
Yeah. Cool, man. Well, we appreciate your time a ton. We don't want to be disruptive to whiskey making. So thank you for taking the time to chat with us, and we're excited to just see you guys grow, and congrats on the success. And, we're always happy to try more stuff. So don't ever hesitate to send it our way.
You got it, man. You got it. I appreciate you guys having me.
Good deal.